Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
The English people are being betrayed. Under the influence of dangerous new foreign ideas, a tiny minority of metropolitan intellectuals are trying to undermine our national history and destroy our traditional culture. Never before has our identity been to... You get the gist. So this is England in the 1530s, it's England in the 1640s, England in the 1700s, the 1900s, the 1960s, and now once again in the 2020s. Welcome to The Rest is History with battle-scarred culture warrior Tom Holland and me, the far more nuanced and reasonable Dominic Sambrook.
Dominic.
Hello, Tom.
Dominic, you are so battle-scarred in the culture wars. I mean, you write for the Daily Mail. That's the essence of a culture warrior.
Okay, you're going to go there straight away. Fair enough. Now I know where we stand.
I'm hacking
so
you down.
So we've been
early.
Talking. We are going to get into the history of culture wars, aren't we? We're not. Well, maybe we'll fight some culture wars in the second half of the pod, but maybe to start with. I think it's really this is such a hot topic, and I think we should really sort of get into what culture wars are. Are they confected? You know, where do they come from historically? And we might as well start, I think, Tom, with a question. So we've got a question from Gilberto Morbach, who says, what is the first instance of a culture war? He says, it's not the Kulturkampf, which is Bismarck's war against the Catholic Church itself. Now, I don't think it is. I think culture wars are as old as history itself. And I think they go back to, you know, what are the Greeks and the Persians but a culture war? What are the arguments within the Roman Republic but a culture war? But maybe, Tom, you disagree.
I do disagree, because I think that if you use culture war to mean the war between two different cultures, I mean, that's every war. Every war is bringing different perspectives, different cultural understandings, different cultural assumptions. So you might just as well say war. I think
but that's not quite... But the idea of... that's not really what I mean. What I mean is... The argument about who should we be? What are our values? What's our identity? I mean, Greeks did argue about those things, and Romans argued about them and said, you know, are we becoming too Greek? Are we becoming too Persian? Are we betraying our ancestors? Are we living up to our history? All those arguments, which we have as Britons right now, or Americans, they are as old as history itself.
But you see, I think that's like saying that Julius Caesar conquered France. It's kind of true, but it's also missing quite a lot, and I think it risks anachronism. So okay. I do think that the Kulturkampf, you know, it begins with, yeah, basically it does begin with Bismarck and the conflict with the Catholic Church as a concept, as a category, and perhaps you can then back project that in a certain way. But I think that essentially the culture war that Bismarck is engaged in is over the limits of religious authority over a secularizing state. So I think it's about the tensions between the secular and the self-professingly Christian.
But what an astonishing surprise.
Yeah, but as you will know, of course, the concept of the secular is itself a Christian one. So what I would say a culture war is basically it's sublimated theology. So it is generated out of a specifically Christian context, but it's a context in which one side no longer recognizes itself as being Christian. So it's a kind of post-Christian war. So I think all the culture wars in America, they are essentially all revolving around issues of Christian theology. It's just that one side doesn't recognize that, and one side does.
But let's go back, Tom. I want to go back further before we get back to Bismarck and Christianity and stuff. Are you saying that when in the sort of the later days of the Roman Republic, which you've written about, you know, so successfully, when people are arguing that the founding ideals, the sort of puritanical, what they see as the puritanical ideals of the Republic have been lost, and they are arguing about what they see as the luxurious effeminacy and decadence of the modern age, and you know, people like Cato are arguing against what they see as the sort of the new people who are un-Roman and all that stuff. You don't think there's a culture war element to that? You really don't?
I think it's more about political style, because that's the essence of...
But that's what culture wars are about now.
I'm not sure it is, because I think that it's about... I think that baked into our understanding of culture war, and unless it's going to become something so kind of broad-reaching that it just becomes nebulous and pointless, is the idea of progress. It's the idea of whether you're on the side of progress or not. So it requires people who feel that they're progressive, and people who feel that progress is actually a form of loss, so a kind of conservatism. There are, of course, you know, there are people who define themselves absolutely as conservatives in Rome. But
yeah, well, Cato would be a great example,
But Caesar is not. He's upholding a kind of style. It's a kind of flash. It's a kind of an appeal to the tastes of the people. But it's not going against the very idea of Rome. It's not kind of formulating the idea that there are customs and practices that are superseded that should be jettisoned. I think the closest approximation to a culture war, I think, that you get in Roman history is one where Christian ideas about what a society should properly be are coming up against traditional Roman ideals, because that genuinely is a kind of a clash. And I think that the Christians who are opposing certain aspects of Roman culture are doing it in a way that we could perhaps define as progressive. They're kind of saying things can be improved, things can be better, and the traditions that you are upholding are antiquated and should be jettisoned.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that when Christianity comes in, because there surely you must have a sense. I mean, it's very hard to get hold of that now because our sources are so limited, but you must have a sense of people in Rome in the days of Constantine the Great and his successors. Well, I suppose more his successors, who are saying, you know, I was always brought up to believe X, Y, and Z, and now everything that I believed has been turned on its head. And isn't it awful that these shrieking, strident people, in this case the Christians, are taking our country from us? I mean, they wouldn't have said our country, but you know, our world from us, and turning everything on its head. I just believe what people believed 20 years ago, and suddenly I'm told that's all wrong. I don't even know what the right words are. We know the lingo, so aren't they saying exactly that then?
So what Christians are bringing in to the party is, first of all, the idea that there is a kind of universal identity that transcends the local. So Roman traditions are not that important. They're relative to the good news of that Christians bring, which are properly universal. And also the other idea is that certain aspects of Roman culture are not just kind of irrelevant, but literally demonic, and therefore have to be abolished in the name of something that perhaps rather anachronistically we could call progress, because Christians would see the removal of the demonic as improving life for society and everybody within it.
So is that things like gladiatorial?
Yeah.
Slavery.
There's one particular kind of incident, which is famous, which takes place in the late 4th century. There is an altar in the Senate House called the Altar of Victory, which serves as a symbol for the Romans of the glories of their past. So there's a statue of Victory, Nike, which dates back to the wars with Pyrrhus, say before the time of Hannibal even. And the altar itself has been put there by Augustus to celebrate his victories over Antony and Cleopatra. So it's absolutely, you know, it's Nelson's column. It's everything that the Romans kind of see as embodying their martial glory. Statue of Churchill. Churchill. Yes, absolutely. And the Christians hate it because it requires people to burn incense, to offer sacrifice to these gods who Christians see as demonic. So they're constantly agitating to have it removed. And 357, Constantius II does remove it. Then he's succeeded by Julian, who is notoriously known by the Christians as the apostate because he wants to reintroduce paganism. So he brings it back in. Then it gets removed again in 382. And the emperor who does that, a guy called Gratian, then dies in a coup. And his half-brother, Valentinian II, is then petitioned to bring it back. And the reason that this is very well documented is that we have both sides. So we have a guy called Symmachus, who is a senator, a pagan senator, who's writing to the emperor and saying, look, you know, live and let live. Christians can have their churches. Why can't we have our altar? Sure, that's fine. And then we have the response from St. Ambrose, who's the Bishop of Milan, saying we cannot negotiate with this because this is demonic. It has to be got rid of. We have no compromise at all. And I think there you do see a kind of a proto-example of the contours that the culture wars in our society will take on. The sense that certain things for those who are identifying themselves with what we might call the progressive cause is non-negotiable. And that the detritus of the past cannot just be tolerated, it has to be removed. So I think
Tom, I think you've brilliantly disproved your argument
because
that to me is utterly compelling. I mean, that sounds completely recognisable. Ambrose is woke, and the other fellow is unwoke,
What I would grant is that there are certainly cultural war elements within Christianity's relationship to the pre-existing society. And it's there, for instance, also in the anxieties that Christian philosophers and theologians feel in their attitude towards pagan literature. So in the 10th century, there's an abbot of Cluny who has a dream in which he sees a vase and it's full of coiling snakes, three coiling snakes. And he wakes and an angel appears and says, these snakes are Virgil and Horace and Ovid. So you must get rid of them. Meanwhile, simultaneously, in Ravenna, you have people who are saying that actually we should be studying Virgil rather than the Gospels because they're much better. So that I guess is a kind of, you know, there are kind of prefigurings there of trends that we recognise. But I think that basically what is happening there is that it's the tension between a fundamentally Christian society and a society that is not identifying itself as Christian. And I think that
Do they want to cancel literature, for example?
Not really. Some do, but it's a kind of minority. But there's always a slight ambivalence around it. And I think that, you know, there are kind of, I mean, I would argue that the, say, you know, people giving warnings before, trigger warnings before studying Ovid or something in a 21st century American university, that there is a kind of echo there of the ambivalences that Christians felt, say, towards Ovid or Virgil in late antiquity. And I think that essentially but in both cases, it's bred of deeply Christian assumptions about both the universal and the progressive. And I think that those are the keys.
What you also get in this period, Tom, well, sort of late antiquity, early medieval, is a huge amount of hullabaloo about images. And one thing that does strike me as a kind of continuity is that obviously there is a torrent of stuff at the moment about statues and about plaques to people. And, you know, who you celebrate in the graven image. And that's there in, you know, that's in there in Byzantium and the arguments about iconoclasm. And then there again, I think, don't you see the same kind of thing? People who say, well, I've been brought up to believe X, Y and Z. I've always believed that these images were an important part of that. They're central to our culture and our imaginative and religious, our spiritual world. And now these bastards are coming along and whitewashing them and getting rid of them, just as they obviously later do in the Reformation. And that seems to me to be That's a fascinating impulse running through the last 2,000 years. Constant battles about images and who you put up and whether it's right to put up an image at all.
But I was kind of thinking about this, knowing that we were going to be talking about this. And I just kind of have this... I feel that that's different because those are Christians arguing in Christian terms about what should be done. So the arguments about icons in Byzantium and about images in the 16th century are people who both accept that they're Christians on both sides. So it's arguments about theology where both are recognizing that they're arguing about theology. I think,
but they don't think the other people are good Christians, though, do they?
No, they don't.
They really they don't think the other people are good Christians.
But I think the definition of a culture war is where both sides are essentially debating theological terms, but only one side doesn't recognize it.
Okay, so explain that to me. You think one side pluralist and the other not pluralist?
So on the statues issue, there is absolutely, of course, Christian culture introduces a huge ambivalence about statues, and the idea of putting up statues to memorialize great figures is a very culturally specific one. It's one that the Greeks have and particularly the Romans have. So the Romans are always shoving up statues of their great generals and their great men. And essentially the trend in modern Europe to do that reflects a kind of loosening of specifically Christian understandings about what is acceptable in the public space. So it's in the 17th century really, and then through into the 18th century that you start getting people saying, you know, we too have great men. You know, this is increasing identification with particularly Rome. So you know, the 18th century is known as the Augustan age. So it's in the 18th century that you start getting people putting up statues of great men, of generals and kings, but also benefactors, Christian benefactors. So up they go. And that's why most of the statues in our public spaces represent figures from the 18th and the 19th and the early 20th centuries.
Yeah, because the age of empire.
Yeah, because this is a classicizing age. This is an age that is looking back to the Roman age. Now, I think that the anxieties around statues today are bred of kind of deeply Christian ideas. It's just that the people who are campaigning against it wouldn't recognize that as being Christian. But essentially the sense that we can't have a statue up because it commemorates depravity and evil. So if it's a slave trader or an imperialist or whatever, you know, this is drawing on the assumption that to make a profit from slaves or to conquer vast reaches of territory and kill people while doing so is not something that is deserving of praise. And these are assumptions that are bred of the great heritage of our Christian history. But they've kind of escaped the moorings of specific Christian doctrine, and they now just kind of percolate in the air and people just kind of breathe them in and take them for granted. But that, I think, is, for me, that's what I would see the culture wars as being, is that it's arguments about theology that do not recognise themselves as being arguments about theology.
So then when you go back to... So let's go back to the Reformation, because I thought we'd spend a lot of time talking about the Reformation, because when the George Floyd was killed, Black Lives Matter kicked off, there was a ton of stuff. We were obviously in lockdown at that point. That was last year in the sort of middle of 2020. So it monopolised... It was the one story that wasn't the coronavirus, basically. And at that very moment, I was writing my children... This is a good plug, actually. I was writing my children's book about Henry VIII and his six wives. And so I was reading books about the Reformation, like Peter Marshall's great book, Heretics and Reformers, about a brilliant, one of the best history books I think I've ever read, about the English Reformation. And I was thinking to myself how uncannily similar this is. You know, these accounts by sort of good Catholics of their shock and their horror as Protestants with imported ideas, you know, clever, well-connected, affluent merchants and stuff with European ideas that have travelled along the trade routes. You know, that these are literate people who are saying, no, everything you believed was wrong. You know, you should educate yourself. You should purge your church. You should do all this. And I thought, there is such continuity here. You know, it's hard to tell where the news ends and this history book begins.
I completely agree. Absolutely there is continuity there. I completely agree. It's just that for me, the word culture war, is it kind of, you know, it's coined in Bismarck's Germany, and then as it evolves with its use in America, I think that of course all these trends, all these wars, all these battles are inherited from Christian paradigms. It's just that I think that what we mean by culture wars, it refers to arguments about theology that do not recognize themselves as being about theology, whereas in the Reformation they do. So I completely agree that reading the accounts of the iconoclasm in, you know, towns and cities that are becoming Protestant, where people are going into cathedrals and smashing crucifixes and kind of mocking statues of the Virgin and chucking statues of saints into the river. I mean, it is kind of shocking, but it's done in overtly theological terms. The justifications for them are given in terms of scripture and theology. That's not what happens now. So when people argue about trans rights or about statues or abortion or whatever, the arguments are framed often, I mean, often, so abortion or gay rights or something like that, it's often cast as, you know, it's Christians against progressives. So it's the Christians who are the conservatives now, and it's the progressives who are turning their back on that as kind of benighted superstition. But what I think is that the progressives are drawing just as much on that inheritance of Christian history and theology as the self-confessing Christians. It's just that they don't recognise it. So that's what, yes, I think a culture
Alice
war
Roberts
is.
Will not approve of your argument there, Tom.
Yeah, so Alice Roberts is absolutely a figure who would be unthinkable in any other context except a kind of Protestant Christian one. But she doesn't accept that. That's what makes her a culture warrior rather than a Christian contestant in an intra-Christian war.
And such an entertaining comic figure. But anyway, there's one other dimension to this, which I think is really interesting, that you, I imagine, will completely reject. And that is the sort of more overtly political dimension. So to me, I would argue, and you clearly would disagree, that British politics has always been a kind of culture war. This is what, for example, Robert Toombs argues in his book, The English and Their History. He argues that English politics specifically has always had this culture war dimension, that it's always been, there's always been a religious gap. You know, the Tories and the Conservatives are the kind of Church of England at the voting booth, and that the sort of liberal left-wing tendency, particularly in middle-class life, has always been driven by kind of religious nonconformity and by the tradition of dissent. And actually, you know, when I look back at the period that politics was born, that what we would recognise as politics, so you're talking about late 17th, early 18th century, I mean, it's shot through with arguments about sort of culture war kind of issues. I mean, the example, I know you've read this piece that I wrote a few weeks ago for Unheard about the Sir Cheverell case. So there you've got a preacher, you know, that's the single biggest issue in the general election of 1710. And it's a preacher who has condemned the Whigs and condemned dissenters, and the Tories pick it up and they run with it and they amplify it into a sort of major national political issue in a way that people now would say, oh, typical Tories confecting a culture war, all this sort of stuff. I mean, people are doing it right back then in the 17th, sort of 18th centuries. So to me, culture wars and sort of, you know, partisan parliamentary politics have always gone hand in hand to some extent.
I don't disagree, and I read your essay and thought it was fantastic. And this, people who haven't read it,
it
was in Unheard a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? I mean, I thought it was fantastic, and it kind of really made me think about this. So, and what I think about that is that I would say that the disagreements, the conflicts, the tensions, the cultural arguments, say, in the period of the Protectorate after the Civil War, where you have all these kind of rival religious denominations all debating with each other, I would not see that as being a culture war, because I think that's still being conducted in overtly Christian terms. But something like Whiggery might evolve
Whiggery
out of that.
Whiggery is progress.
So Whiggery, yeah. It's a kind of secular idea of progress. And that is absolutely coming up against the kind of Tory idea of the Church of England, that it should be, you know, that this is anathema. So I do completely agree that I think that that is kind of, you know, that's the precursor to the modern culture war, because with Whiggery, you're getting the idea of, you know, it's clearly a massively theological concept that could only have emerged. And it clearly does emerge from the argument between established church and dissenters in the 17th century. But it loses it, you know, it slips that mooring. So I think that kind of 18th century argument I completely accept the validity of that.
And what do you think about whether there's a sort of temperamental, as it were, impulse behind these things, that we are all little, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan had this, liberals or little, we're all born little liberals or little conservatives. I mean, we're all born culture warriors. Do you not think, to an extent, we all have an instinctive, even if you haven't thought about the issues or you're not steeped in the history or the theology or whatever, you know, people have a very instinctive, visceral reaction to these things. Are they somebody who values tradition and conservatism and how things have always been done? Or do they want to see themselves on the side of progress? And are they horrified at the thought of being, you know, on the wrong side of history and all that stuff? I mean, those things are quite, they're quite innate, aren't they, don't you think?
Yes, but I think that, it won't surprise you to hear me say this, I do think that Christianity radically alters the terms of the debate, because back in ancient times, basically everyone was a conservative. So even if they wanted to change things, and often, of course, they did, I mean, you know, constant process of change, but they would always justify it by saying that they were going back to the way that things were always done. So the Athenian, you know, when the Athenian democracy gets set up, this incredibly radical experiment, they say, well, we're just going back to do what Theseus set up. And and Augustus, when he, in, you know, he plants his autocracy on the rubble of the Republic, he says, well, I'm, you know, back to basics. I'm restoring the Republic. I'm restoring the way that things always were. And I think that that what changes with Christianity and what is really manifest in our society now is the idea that actually change for its own sake becomes a good, that there is such a thing as an arc of progress, and that you're either with that arc of progress or you're not. So I agree that there is a kind of, you know, you either have a kind of, you know, you relish change and you enjoy the excitement that it represents, or you have a kind of instinctive shrinking from it and you just wish that things could stay as they were. And I agree that's a temperamental thing. But I think that what changes with Christianity is that then becomes much more kind of ideological divide. And I think that we live in the kind of aftermath of that now. I also think that we've possibly talked about this long enough and that we need a break. What do you think?
I was just thinking that. I was thinking about how I was going to get us into the break. Tom, I think you need to tool up, sharpen your weapons, and the battle will resume after this, after a word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals.
You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome back to The Rest is History, and welcome back to the Culture Wars, which Tom Holland and I are engaged in right now. Tom, America. America, we've had a whole podcast about Americanization, so we don't need to do that again. But America clearly plays a huge part in the Culture Wars. Now, I'll tell you my thesis, and then you can reject it. I mean, I think basically when the settlers and the sort of Puritans and stuff went to America, they took the Culture Wars with them, and that the arguments, all the arguments you see in America are descended from 17th, 18th century British, sort of English and Scottish arguments, and that what's happened is that America has now re-exported those arguments back to us. So we see them as American, but actually they are ultimately kind of Whig, Tory, good old cause, Civil War era kinds of arguments. So they're, and they've survived in America in such a sort of intense form because America is much more religious than the UK is. So the intensity of their culture wars, it seems to me, is a very religiously inspired thing. Do you buy that?
Completely.
Yes, I knew you would.
I do. Very good. And I think that, you know, we talked about that in the Americanization podcast. That's one of the reasons why we're so susceptible to catching colds when American culture wars warriors sneeze, is that basically we have no natural immunity to it because right. It came from us. I think that what has made culture wars in America particularly virulent is, as you say, that it is a much more committedly Christian society than Britain's been for a fair while. And I think that what happens in the 60s and 70s is that religious culture mutates in a very, very profound way, in a way that is kind of analogous to the 1520s, really. I mean, it's a change in the fabric of Christian thought on that scale, beginnings of the Reformation. Because what you get in the 50s and 60s is the Civil Rights Movement, which is a deeply, yeah, deeply Christian movement. The Reverend Martin Luther King. And his language is absolutely steeped in biblical narratives. So the language of Exodus, the idea that God leads slaves out of Egypt, that he's on the side of those who are oppressed rather than on the side of Pharaoh. And of course, he's invoking Christ, the guy who dies the death of a slave, all the time. And essentially, that's what gives the civil rights movement its traction, is that he is able to remind white American Christians that if there is no Jew or Greek, then there is no black or white in Christ. And white Christians accept, essentially, you know, within limits, accept the justice of that argument. And that establishes a template for other people who come from sidelined communities, people who feel that they've been suffering oppression from majority rule, to do the same. So gay rights would be an example of that. I guess even feminism would be an example of that, both of which gain enormous kind of sustenance from the example of the civil rights movement and the campaign for racial justice. But the problem, I guess, for practicing Christians with feminism and even more with gay rights, is that the arguments and certainly the rhetoric rub up against a traditional Christian understanding and kind of scriptural dictates in a way that the campaign for racial justice hadn't. And so what you get over the course of the 70s is that, you know, in culture wars, it forces people to take sides. And so people who are practicing Christians increasingly come to identify as conservatives, people who are under attack from people who are not Christian. And progressives likewise increasingly come to identify Christianity as being something repressive, negative, something that has to conservative, fossilized, something that has to oppressive, something that has to be jettisoned. And so essentially those are the kind of the battle lines that you know, the trenches still run across America to this day, where you have people who say, I'm Christian, I hate progressives. You have progressives who say, I'm a progressive, I hate Christians. But basically, both sides are articulating arguments drawn from the same kind of great seedbed of Christian thought. So I think, you know, it's not a Christian against progressive war. It's a Christian civil war. But what makes it a culture war in my light is that only one side recognises that.
Have you read this book by James Davison Hunter? So this is the book that enshrines the term culture wars, published in 1991, American sociologist. Now, what he basically says is it's the clash between the orthodox and the progressive. He says you don't have to be a Christian to be on the orthodox side. You just believe in tradition, you believe in the nuclear family, you believe in, you know, your country and the military and all these kinds of things. And then there's the progressives. And he said that, it's very hard to find that politics is increasingly being fought out on those lines. And that obviously now people talk a lot. So political scientists in Britain talk a lot about how the Conservatives, for example, have moved from being a sort of the Thatcherite party, the party of neoliberalism, as people call it, to being one that fights on more overtly cultural grounds, cultural conservative grounds. And people sometimes talk about that as though this is this tremendous new thing. But it seems to me that politics has always been fought out on that. There's always been the orthodox progressive, particularly in America, in American politics. I think that tension has kind of always been there. It's certainly been there since the end of the Second World War, no doubt about that.
Yeah, and I think escalating since the 60s. I think the 60s is a really crucial decade. But I thought also what was brilliant in your essay, which I also think is completely true, is that the culture war issues are a bit like personalities in politics, that politicians are always saying people aren't really interested in this kind of nonsense. People just want to talk about, you know, the inflation rate NHS funding or something. But it's evident that culture wars kind of blaze into fire because for lots of people, they're enormous fun.
Well, I have very strong views about this. So
do you
think
have strong views, Dominic?
People who are interested in politics. I think one of the extraordinary things about people who are interested in politics is often they don't really understand. They're very interested in politics, but that makes them very bad judges of politics and how politics works because they're interested in it. So because they're super interested in politics, they think that everybody else is interested in the same things that they are. It's rather like somebody who's incredibly interested in a particular sport and in the sort of statistics of it, understanding what other people see in it. Often they don't. And I think with politics, these arguments that sort of political obsessives and kind of Guardian columnists think are contrived and confected about flags and statues, you will ordinary people, as it were, ordinary people, I know I sound like I'm getting into my column writing vein, but sort of, as it were, ordinary people, people who are not very interested in politics, find those in much more interesting subjects than exactly that, some arcane discussion about inflation or something. They are very emotive, very powerful subjects, and always have been.
But and that's true the other way around, isn't it? That people on the left, likewise, are equally as obsessed by these topics as people on the right.
Yes, I suppose I think that's probably true. They're more emotive to people on the left, aren't they? But that raises that left-right issue. It raises another interesting dimension, which I don't think quite fits with your theology thing, which is a big element of the culture wars right now in Britain are about Britishness and about patriotism. So Orwell would have recognised all this, because Orwell in the 1940s, he says, you know, he mocks. Orwell is the great man, of course. He's every conservative columnist's go-to for kind of quotations, because he's kind of on the left, but he loves nothing better than basically mocking other lefties. And he sort of says, you know, the British intelligentsia, they get their cooking from Paris and their opinions from Moscow. They would rather be seen stealing from a poor box than standing to sing God Save the King and all this sort of thing. And there's this interesting element of kind of peculiarly national self-loathing. You do get that a bit, I think, in America, but, you know, the British, I think, lead the world. I mean, if we do lead the world in one thing, it is self-flagellation about our sins. And I wonder how that fits into your, because I think there's a really interesting and strange thing at the heart of Britishness that has always been there to some extent, which is a kind of, we are uniquely sinful. The British project itself.
Well, there you go.
Is,
I mean, you know, there's the word sinful immediately.
But then you see, if it's Christian, why don't other Christian countries have it?
Well, because
the French, I don't think, have it to the same extent. You know, the Dutch are very proud of their empire. All those kinds of things. Why don't other people have the same self-flagellating instinct that, let's say, the British intelligentsia have?
Well, I think that every country tends to be Christian in a different way, and
okay,
so there's a kind of different inheritance, and I think that in Britain, precisely because it's been such a global power and because its relationship with the broader world has been so formative, both for the British themselves, but also for people who have had the British turn up and been yeah. formative on them. the kind of tension that exists within Christianity, the suspicion of the specifically national and the embrace of the universal manifests itself in a distinctive way. So if you look back to the altar of victory, essentially the argument is that there is a universal Christian identity, that this is the answer, and that the legacies of kind of Roman militarism and imperialism it's not just that they're specific to the Romans and therefore not of universal import, but also that they're malign and malevolent. And that's always been a deep strain within Christianity. I mean, it's what Catholic means, universal. But obviously, I think that there is a kind of huge human impulse to identify with the local over the universal at the same time. And I think a huge amount of the argument in Britain, therefore, revolves around that issue. Should you emphasise the universal over the local? And
well, it's the citizens of the world the citizens of somewhere versus the citizens of nowhere, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
That's from the Theresa May speech.
Yes.
I mean, because that was an interesting one, because now this is maybe the difference between us. When I heard that speech, I mean, I'm the only person in the world who would admit to this, certainly the only person who does a history podcast. I thought, yes, great, I completely agree with that. That sod the citizens of the world. But of course, most people who are, you know, historians who are kind of part of the literary world do see themselves as citizens of the world. They don't. They see the local as parochial, reading as xenophobic, or as, you know, as nationalistic.
But
or
to, I mean,
like
to
that.
Go back to your fantastic article about the roots of all this in kind of early 18th century politics, the Whigs, as a marker of their kind of progressive identity, kind of scorn Tory roast beef eating patriots like yourself, Dominic.
And Dr. Johnson.
Well, yes, to a degree. And they identify with kind of French ideals. So, I mean, all the way through the Napoleonic Wars, you've got, you know, the Holland House. Aptly named.
Yeah.
They're all
aptly named.
Yes. Lord Holland and so on. They're all kind of, you know, Byron is writing poems lamenting the fall of Napoleon and so on. There's a kind of identification.
Sort of Trumpain and
a sense that that kind of British Toryism is not just parochial but kind of, you know, turpitudinous, that it's xenophobic, and therefore to be properly moral you have to identify with the ideals of and the cultures of places beyond the shores of Britain. And I think that's always been a huge trend, and it's always particularly appealed to intellectuals and writers and poets. So Shelley and Byron are this is absolutely what they are articulating, and I guess that today is no different, that by and large that's the metropolitan liberal elites.
It is.
That's,
I remember.
But Holland House is in the Holland House is heaving with, you know, in the Regency period is heaving with metropolitan liberal elites, the equivalent.
I was about to say. I remember being at Oxford in the 1990s and hearing for the first time. So England were playing a World Cup qualifier or something, football, and hearing for the first time other students saying, "How can you support England? You know,
anyone but England.
Support your own country." And I was utterly dumbfounded, because it was the first time I'd encountered this, having sort of grown up and, you know, in the heart
in a
of
hobbit
England,
hole
as you know, yeah, in my hobbit
in
hole
the Shire,
and
again,
and Yeah, surrounded by the ghosts of Nelson and
Toby Jones.
And all the, exactly. So I couldn't believe that there would be people who were clearly English who would not support their own. And they said it wasn't just the anyone but England thing. It was also they didn't agree with the principle of supporting your national team at all, no matter who you were. If you were Burkina Faso, they wouldn't agree with supporting your own team because they thought that was
nationalistic. In which case, why were they watching football? I mean, isn't the whole point
They were trying to dissuade other people from watching it. They just thought the idea of international football.
That's what they always say about football is that it's tribal, don't they? I mean, we saw that with the whole debate over the Super League. Is that the essence? You know, the essence of the argument, which I thought was really interesting, and how rapidly everybody agreed with it, was that football clubs should be local. And you're right. They shouldn't be the property of kind of global supporters. That really, it's rooted in the. Local communities, and suddenly everyone was becoming kind of Tory, you know, in the 18th century sense.
I think what's quite interesting is that there were some people, their voices were completely drowned out in the end, but particularly in America, there were people, for example, who are New Yorker writers and things, who are interested in soccer because it's, you know, it's seen in America as actually a bit more progressive than supporting American football or baseball. And they liked the idea of the Super League. And they're kind of quite woke people. And it's precisely that reason. Because they thought the idea of the clubs being lifted from the communities and becoming national, global things.
Well, I mean, it's
part of that universalism.
But also it shows,
they liked that.
But also it shows that there is a kind of little conservative within everyone. That if,
well, isn't you know, it said that you're certain, always conservative
certain
about...
Certain things that when they get threatened, suddenly, oh, we've got to defend this. And we can't have this.
Yes, exactly. Let's have a quick question from Alex Shiphorst. So he asks about generational. He asks how much culture wars are generational. Now, you saw that actually with the Super League is a nice link to that because the Super League was supposedly set up for younger supporters who are more likely to be not so tribal and not so local.
And also not to be able to cope with 90-minute games.
Well, yes.
Which obviously is a cricket fan. Supposedly... As a cricket fan, I was very worried about that.
Yes. Yeah, well, of course. So, but of course, the man who was claiming that, Florentino Perez, is about 138. So I'm sure he knows he's got his finger on the pulse of youth. Anyway, Alex Shiphorst says he's thinking about the 1968 protests in France, which do have, I think, a culture war element to them, the protests against de Gaulle. And he says he's thinking about hippies, and he's thinking about arguments today about LGBTQ rights, veganism, etc., etc. So, do you think there's a generational?
I do.
I completely do. But is that normal though in a culture war?
I think so.
Right. So what you get, I guess, is the standard is you get a very progressive, ultra Christian younger generation, and an older, less Christian. More orthodox, more conservative one. Is that right? That's how you see the dynamic always working?
I think the dynamic has always been, since the 12th century, that these kind of impulses to purify the whole of Christendom, the world, to this kind of mission to improve everybody. Initially, of course, absolutely couched in overtly Christian terms. In the 12th century, this leads to the setting up of universities. Universities are basically founded to train people who can provide the kind of moral and legal frameworks that can then govern.
As now,
yeah,
the madrasas of the culture war.
Yeah, and so what then happens is that you get young people going there studying, then going out to work as priests or clerics or whatever, and coming up against people who are going, what the hell are you talking about? I mean, that's essentially what the Albigensian Crusade is. The Albigensian Crusade is a targeting of the left behind, of deplorables, of people who are not up to speed.
Oh, my God.
This is the sort of anti-racism
sort of training people of the medieval period.
Yes, the Albigensian Crusade is a kind of very, very brutal, you know, it's like the student coming back and shouting at the father for using the wrong words on a kind of very, very militant scale. There's a sense in which the Protestant Reformation is the same and the French Revolution. And I think that you see exactly the same, that it's the universities. The role of the universities has always been to kind of educate and articulate progressive orthodoxies in a kind of radical new way. And inevitably, because it's in the universities that train the teachers who go out into the schools, who then teach the young, who then go through the educational system, who then become the teachers themselves. And so it percolates outwards and outwards.
That's
and outwards.
So
and so every generation you will find, I mean, I used to think of myself as progressive, but now that I've got children, I know I'm not really progressive.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
I know. But also perhaps it's also because as you get older, you regard as normal things that you had in your youth,
course,
and therefore you don't want them to change. So I think also, that's
Tom,
also
I don't want to incriminate you on the podcast, but I think you were one of the first people I'd ever met who said to me, it was just after the Iraq War or thereabouts, and you said you really liked Tony Blair because he made Britain look strong.
he made Britain look good in a kind of bicycle riding.
That's not what you said at the time. You used the word strong. That's it's the first person I'd met in the sort of literary world who used the word strong approvingly of a political leader.
Well, there's a kind of muscular quality. There was a muscular quality to
it. Christianity.
A kind of self-assurance and a sense of purpose, which I must say I still slightly wistful for.
Now that I've got you cancelled, I wanted to. You asked about.
Well, don't worry, I've never concealed my admiration for.
No, you haven't. To be fair, you were waxing lyrical about him in our Prime Ministerial World Cup. So you were talking about universities, and I think that's a really good point, and it brings up Paul Duncan's question. So Paul Duncan asked the question I basically want the answer to because I want to. He says, "How are culture wars won? I need to know because I will not rest until there's a statue of Field Marshal Lord Roberts in every market town in England." But Paul Duncan says, if you're trying to win a culture war, and it's a key question, are you better off trying to change people's minds or to have your position enforced by the power structures of your time? And before you give your answer, Tom, I was thinking about the Reformation. I mean, the Reformation in England, the English Reformation was by and large, I would say, pretty unpopular. I mean, you've got the Pilgrimage of Grace. You have a series of risings, kind of prayer book risings and all these kinds of things. And the Reformation, it seems to me, wins because it's backed from the top, or at least sort of with a bit of ambiguity, but it's got the state behind it. But also because England is a very young country and people forget quickly. And by the time Mary tries to turn back the clock, she's a culture warrior of a very different kind because she's a kind of reactionary culture warrior, I suppose you'd say. Or at least I'd say, a lot of the people who remember Catholic England are dead, and younger people have grown up knowing only Protestant England. So to some extent, it's just a question of outlasting your opponents and I guess converting the young, which is why I wanted to ask about universities. So do you think that is the way that you win a culture war, through schools and universities? Or is it all kind of control of the state? You know, if Boris Johnson is listening and he wants to win his culture war, can he win without universities, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
I think the universities matter more. And that's kind of the Gramscian idea that you affect change through culture. And I would say that the most dramatic illustration of that, I mean, almost in the whole of history, actually, is the evolution of attitudes to homosexuality over certainly my lifetime. A few years before I was born, it was illegal. Now, essentially, it's illegal not to support it. And, my children, I think, would find it kind of incomprehensible to imagine, that living in a world where it was regarded as criminal. And that's obviously, I think that that's a kind of classic example of where the change of public attitudes, I think, that was much more important than kind of individual politicians stepping in and
absolutely. I completely. I think aren't things like that, and also anti-racism. They're driven by sport. They're driven by
fashion
culture,
and culture
far
and,
more than anything.
But also, I think. Does. But also, I mean, I think accepting the essential justice of a cause. That once something becomes kind of attains a critical mass, then it becomes very, very difficult, I think, to oppose it, and that's kind of what happens with the Reformation. It's what happens with the Christianization of the Roman world, that something can be quite kind of new and shocking to people in the initial onset of this perspective, but once it beds down, it just becomes the kind of standard very, very rapidly.
But it also is about, you want to you know, people don't want to be viewed as eccentrics, do they, by and large? People also, successful, talented people, or people who dream of being successful, they don't want to go, they don't want to espouse views that will lead to their cancellation, as it were. So by definition, as people come up the ladder, they're more likely to go with the new orthodoxy rather than the old.
But I think it's more than that. I think it's not even, oh, I better believe this or else I'll get burnt at the stake or, you know, thrown out of my university post or something. I think it's just people just think this is what I should think, because of course I should think, you know, of course the Pope is Antichrist. Of course gay marriage is absolutely to be celebrated. I mean, it's just what you think.
So here's a counterexample, though. A huge culture war, which we haven't mentioned at all, fought in the course of the 20th century, is communism's culture war on the old. So they have control of the universities. They have control of schools. I mean, they have control in a way that today's culture warriors couldn't dream of. But it doesn't work. And that's an interesting that lots of people, they preserve somehow the old orthodoxies or the old views. You know, the Poles and their Catholicism, for example. So why do you think that particular culture, when they had all that apparatus of victory, didn't work?
Because it doesn't work economically, does it?
So you think it was about the economics rather than...
Well, we talked about that in the communism one, that it's an attempt to create heaven on earth that rubs up against the fact that it's not possible and that essentially, you know, a progress towards dictatorship perhaps is baked into the attempt to impose it.
Whereas, and let's end with this then. Go on.
No, go on.
So we talked about winning and losing. Does it have to be winning and losing, or can there be compromise? You see, what I see all the time is, now this is, I'm now putting on my sort of popular newspaper hat. I see all the time sort of high-minded people moaning and saying, oh, they hate the confected culture war. They hate all this. But then in the next paragraph, they then say how determined they are to win it and to crush their opponents and to strip museums of their problematic artifacts or whatever. So it seems to me they patently clearly like the culture war, or they just want to win it. Can there be a compromise in some of these things, do you think? Can societies find a way through? Or must it end with victory, as it did with the Christians, for example, in Rome, or indeed in the Reformation? Must it end with victory for one side or the other?
Well, I mean, you've argued that the roots of our contemporary culture wars lie in the 18th century, in the Whigs against Tories. I mean, essentially, the lineaments of that argument of that argument is still present today. And there's a sense in which the parliamentary system, the party system in Britain, evolves to create a dialogue between those two rival points of view. So I would say yes, absolutely. Because in a sense, I think that you can see that there are the inheritors of the Whig and Tory traditions of the 18th century are still going strong today. And that, in a sense, our parliamentary system exists to ensure that, if not necessarily compromise, then at least kind of, you know, that people can live alongside each other in the same country and have these arguments. I know you disagree.
Answer from Tom. I want a total crushing defeat of the Whigs.
Okay, well, culture warrior.
I used to like the Whigs, but I've now just taken against them completely. Okay, so this particular battle, I think, Tom, is over. You should retreat to lick your wounds. The war, of course.
You have
the
won.
War, of course, continues. As indeed does this podcast. So we will be back, Tom, next week with the French Revolution, another very good culture war.
But before that, we're back.
Oh, yes. with
a podcast episode on a literal war, the Seven Years' War.
Seven Years' War, not a culture war. Then the French Revolution, definitely a culture war.
Definitely is.
And then food with Penn Vogler, very entertaining food historian. Food, of course, is a culture war of a different kind. Guillotines, pies, Seven Years' War, we've got them all. And that note, goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Hi. I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.